Good. You want to kick it off?
No, you're the kickoff guy. You're like the official announcer of this podcast.
I'm the official announcer.
It's a new season, Daniel. Might be time to reinvent yourself.
That's true.
Guys, there's a flock of geese in my neighborhood, so...
We've just gotten...
Just so you know.
FYI. PSA.
FYI.
All right, go ahead. Sorry.
Welcome back. Welcome back. This is season two, I guess we're calling it. Is that right, Daniel? We're calling it season two of Fits and Starts.
It's the second series, yeah.
The second series, the second sprint, as it were, of our podcast. This is where we're going to start bringing in some other people. And the show, as we've said, is going to keep on being about the show, right? It's still about mindfulness and work and how we do our work and how other young people do their work and how we think about our work and when to change. But we're going to keep on talking about the show, talking about the topics at hand. But we're going to bring in some other people, some different voices, some people who run companies, some people who are employees at companies, some people who are in the creative space, some people who are freelancers. And this is the first one. And we are going to be talking to Isaiah Smallman. And Daniel, do you want to do a quick little intro on Zay?
I guess I met Zay once upon a time, way back in the day. I went to high school with Zay's brother, and then we met, and I think we went to the same college. He went to the same college that we all went to, and now he runs what can only be referred to as a myriad of companies that all involve pointing cameras at people and for various reasons, for fun and profit.
I think there might be other ways you could describe it other than myriad, but...
Nope, that's the one.
That's the only one. So, yeah, Zay...
You could call it a swath.
Uh-huh, yeah, a swath of two companies.
Of companies.
Well, the first of which, he started Fancy Rhino with co-founder Drew Bells.
I made their first website.
Daniel made their first website. They were a video production company. For hire, and they made some really interesting content for kind of their own projects as well as commercial work for some pretty impressive clients. And Zay went on to start Mama Bear Studios, which he's now focused more on, which is an actual film production company. And they just released recently their first big project, Hunter Gatherer, which was met by some serious critical acclaim and festival buzz. And looks like it's going to be on Netflix coming up soon. So watch out for that. Anything else we should say?
No.
He's a nice person as well. Like, personally, I find him appealing. Not just professionally.
Thank you, Daniel.
Hello. Can you tell me what the point of the podcast is?
Oh, gosh.
Fits and Starts is about...
It's all about work.
Yeah, it's nice having some, like, younger people who talk about...
The struggles of being 20-something and kind of feeling... somewhat nomadic.
There's got to be an angle. What's the angle? They cover a wide range of topics. Sometimes they get off track, but that's okay.
Sorry.
Fits and starts.
Yeah, can we wrap this up in 5 minutes? I gotta watch Jeopardy.
Wait, what? Oh yeah, you should listen to this.
I should and I will.
This week, we talk about who should and should not take venture capital money, the mysteries of human resources, and then Zay breaks down the movie industry for us. As always, thanks so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, tell a friend about it.
You mentioned kind of earlier that you have investors and you took money to start Fancy. What has that experience been like? Because I've always been a person who like wanted to start a company, mm-hmm. and... There's like always the question of like, do I start a company that like needs funding? And then like I have investors and that's like a whole responsibility of like managing investors and managing their money and like they need a return. And so there's kind of like a requirement to grow at a certain rate, right?
Right.
And then there's like the other side where it's like, oh, well, I could start like a quote unquote lifestyle business, which we talk about a lot on here. And start something that sort of like grows organically, but it's a lot harder to like bootstrap that unless you're sitting on a load of cash or, you know, don't have any expenses.
Sure.
So like how was the experience, especially cause like your dad actually, I actually used to work for your dad at 15-4.
Oh, I know.
And having experienced like seeing like another company that does similar stuff to Fancy that didn't take money, like, you've kind of seen both sides of it in very similar companies. Mm-hmm. How do you feel? Like, are you glad you took the money? Would you take the money again? Or like, what's the experience of taking the money like?
When it comes to fancy, it's always sort of lived in a little bit of, I guess you could say, like, a gray area between those two. We started it as more of what you described as kind of a lifestyle business, or at the very least, I guess you could say, sort of an organically focused, like, growth focused type company. Investment was not really on our radar. And we actually, kind of on a whim, we entered a business plan competition at Covenant, which is where we went to school. We all went to school there. And we kind of entered it because there was a $10,000 prize. And we were like, okay, whatever. Like, it's the first year. You know, we could probably win this thing. We could use 10 grand. Let's freaking go for it. And so we entered it, ended up winning. And, you know, the 10 grand was nice, but that was actually how we met our investors. One of the judges on the sort of deciding panel was part of this new group in town called the Lamppost Group, which basically the founders of Lamppost had started this very successful transportation logistics company and had started this business incubator / venture capital fund. When they approached us, they kind of had us down to our office. I knew less than zero about how venture capital of any kind works. And so they had us down, and Drew and I were kind of like, we're good. Thank you, though. Their reaction to that was very kindly, and they were very much right in saying this, but A, do you actually know how to run a business, or do you know how to make videos? That was a very good question. The answer was, yes, we know how to make videos, but no, in fact, we do not know how to run a company. And the second sort of case that they made to us was, you know, would you rather own 100% of a pizza that's, you know, 12 inches in diameter, or would you rather own, you know, 40% or 30% or whatever it worked out to of a pizza that's the size of this room? And it was like, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense. We never needed this massive capital infusion to kind of get off the ground. It's like when we met our investors, we were already kind of going. And I think in hindsight, we very much needed them. But at the time, it seemed like, man, we could kind of keep going this way. And so there was never this big moment of like, great, now we have all of this money. What do we do with it? It was kind of like, great, let's sell a relatively small percentage of the company in exchange more for mentorship, back office support. You know, they have accountants on staff because they were running this massive logistics company. And so part of their model was like, we have 30 accounts payable people and, or, you know, another 30 accounts receivable people and a bunch of accountants, and adding one more sort of little business to help manage is not going to be a big load on them. And so a part of their pitch was kind of like, hey, we'll help you actually do the stuff that actually makes a business work so that you can kind of focus on what you actually like doing. And that's kind of a unique opportunity. Most investors don't do that. You know, it's much more of a hands-off approach.
One of the things that is just interesting to me, because this idea of the lifestyle business, and it's interesting because I think in some circles it's talked about in almost like a pejorative way, right, where people talk about, you know, you get out of college, you start this thing in your garage, you start going around shooting movies with your partner Drew, and you start running around and trying to make things and trying to, you know, whatever, drum up some interest, and then you go out and raise capital because that's what real businesses do, right? That's what right, the grown-ups do. It's like you go out and raise venture capital because that's how you know that you've made it. And if you don't, if you can't get money from them, maybe you just grow organically and you turn it into a lifestyle business. But I actually think and it's interesting because we haven't actually talked about venture capital that much on this show, but since it's my job, I do have some kind of strong feelings about this. I feel like way more businesses should be lifestyle businesses. I think it's actually a really legitimate, cool way to do things. And I'm struck more and more by this feeling that most businesses, most of the time, don't need venture capital, right? I feel like venture capital is this thing that's like, it's a really specific solution to a very specific problem, right? It's for companies that are poised to have really exponential, intense growth that is exceeding, you know, what they're able to keep up with. And just with the only thing, you know, the very last thing that's holding them back from really expanding rapidly and scaling up is just cash. It's the only thing standing between them and massive success. And in that scenario, and maybe only in that scenario, it feels like venture capital is appropriate. But we've seen a few different cases where, like, I feel like companies that maybe shouldn't have taken it, or maybe didn't, you know, that wasn't their situation, did take it and then had, like, maybe unrealistic expectations of growth, like, kind of hoisted upon them. Did you guys feel right. that at all?
I think, yeah. So, yes. I would say we were not yet successful enough when we began hiring employees to do so in a stable way without the support of venture capital. And again, that was more the access to credit and a small amount of capital than it was kind of this large infusion, if that makes any sense. Now, I think where we got into a little bit of trouble, kind of like what you described, is we started thinking, yeah, this is a nice little business, and if we keep working at it, we could actually figure out how to make a little money. But what if we make it big? You know, and
yeah.
Where we sort of hit trouble and what I was kind of getting to in terms of saying, you know, we've tried to scale two different times, is we got a little bit distracted by some of the shiny stuff of, like, we're really good at making videos. We've got some great clients who love when we make videos. But what if we did four other things for them? What if we were a full service right. agency? Because, you know,
right.
cause we were like working alongside companies that were like 100 times our size. And we were like, man, that would be nice. You know, that I think was where we started to run into trouble, because we don't know how to run a full service agency, you know, and nor do we, once we did it for a little while, nor do we want to, because it's actually kind of sucks, unless that's what you're into. Some people love that. The reality is that being a full service agency is actually, you know, 80% account management. And so we were like, that's not what we set out to do. And so, yeah, I think there was definitely a somewhat of a, not even a pressure, but a knowing that there was this safety net of this company that would kind of back us if we did this, I think led us to make some questionable decisions. For instance, you know, yeah, when we became a full service agency kind of the first time around, we didn't actually know what we were doing. You know, we didn't, we just kind of were like, well, if we're good at this, we'll probably be good at this. We just need to hire some people who know how to do it. And I think what we grossly underestimated is that the very reason that we are killing it in the video space, I should say, we weren't killing it. The very reason that we have a business and that it's working and that clients are hiring us is because, yeah, you can, and we even pitched this to people on a regular basis. We said, because this came up, it was like, yeah, you can hire a video guy, but that's not the same as hiring us, you know? And Daniel, I'm sure you can relate to this in the web space. Like, having a web guy
totally
is completely different than having a really well-functioning web team. And a web team is not three web guys, or I should say web people. It is several web people and someone who is really good at managing them and turning their product into something that a client can actually use, and managing them on not just a sort of logistical level, but managing their personalities, managing the account management of that, which is different for every product that you might be offering. And so there was a false sense of security that came, I think, from being like, well, yeah, we wouldn't do this if it was just our money, but it isn't. So maybe we'll try it and see what happens. And I think that got us into a little bit of trouble at different times. Kind of to bring it back to what you were initially saying, I mean, here's the, to me at least, if venture capital is not essential to starting or to just existing, which in some cases, and in the case of Mama Bear, it is, to, you know, for the most part, I think it can be incredibly helpful, especially if your expectations are set properly. And again, it allowed us to hire people when we needed them as opposed to when we could actually afford them, which I think is a big part of scaling a business, and that's why banks exist. Typically, that sort of thing is funded by debt, and banks loan you money because you have profit, and you sort of experience these certain leverage points where you're like, we are doing something really well. Let's do more of it. You know, that takes capital. And I think the best businesses could theoretically do that growth with their own money, but when you have your own money, money's cheap. And so why on earth would you do it with your own money when you can borrow it from a bank? Does it make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've always been really interested. So like I've worked at like various companies that were like sort of in and around the like agency or consultancy like type of companies. Mm-hmm. The different ways that different companies have done that, especially like depending on what their funding was, has been really interesting. And so like I think I got to the point where like I was no longer interested in working for, and this is not like a lifetime promise, but like for me personally, I wasn't interested in working for companies that had a lot of like investment anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And partly because of that reason, because I was like, man, like the companies that one thing I asked them in my interview, in my like second interview, I was like, do you owe anyone any money? Mm-hmm. Is it a 50-50 equity split? Like, do you guys own 100% of this company? Or like, is there a silent partner? Like, is there someone else in this deal who's not you guys? Because like, I like you guys. Mm-hmm. I trust you guys. But like, I've also like been in situations before where like things were weirder, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I think that's a really smart question to ask.
This is the whole thing, right? Is that people don't realize that once you take venture capital, you are no longer the captain of the ship.
And a 20% margin is not a 20% margin anymore.
Yeah, right. But that idea of just like you are now a very important operator. Probably, you know, if you're the founder and CEO of a company and take on venture capital, you're still, you know, probably the most important operational person like on the ship. But you are no longer the captain of the ship. And that is the craziest thing that I don't think people understand from the outside.
Oh, I mean, several of my friends have gotten fired from their own companies this year. You know, I mean, that's not just the thing in the show Silicon Valley. That's like, that's life, you know, and it's tough.
Is this my house? What happened to my house? Are you my wife?
There's not really much I can do about that, unfortunately.
What's your carpet situation? You have any?
Yeah, I bought a rug from Target.
Mm. Well, are you Skype friends with Mr. Zay Smallman?
Who's that?
In clamshell mode, you say.
I'm going to text him and ask him what his deal is.
Yeah. What's your deal?
I'm standing up for a more active recording session.
Diaphragm. Diaphragm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to be hearing a lot of like creaking right now. I'm creaking a lot of things if you're not hearing that.
Good singing begins with good posture.
Sample that.
Good form, good results. Uh-huh.
Diaphragm.
Say a few words about our friend Zay Smallman.
Welcome back to season two. I'll tell you about Fits and Starts. It's a morale booster. God, like, that's not your Skype name. That's your name.
Oh my goodness, so many notifications.
So this is just something I've started to experience since being at Titan, right? And it's like, it's a company that's small, that's always been small, and they're like, you know, very much in like... When I was hired, there were 10 people.
Okay.
There are, I think, like 12 now.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like beyond like not going out of business, like the biggest thing that they value is like how happy are our employees.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they started a business so that they could have the opportunity to create 12 amazing jobs for people. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's like, I want to start a business so that 12 more people will have great jobs than currently do. Right. You know?
Right.
And that's like a really interesting concept to me, because like some people start businesses to get rich. Some people will start businesses to get famous. Some people start businesses because, you know, they don't want to have a job. that's, I think, the biggest part of my fear of taking money ever, is that, like, no matter how, like, pure your motives are, there's a certain point where someone's going to come through and say, like, you have to do 20% less of that. Mm-hmm. Because, like, 20%, I need 20% more money, you know?
Oh, that's absolutely true.
How that, I guess that's my big question for you. It's not like as much about the money as it is like with a ship that's like changing direction that much, like as you are when you're trying to grow like a small business, especially in the first couple of years, you know, mm-hmm. it's like you guys tried everything. And like, I really admire it. And like, I really like, that's the kind of thing that like gets me really excited, is like, oh, we could just like try all the things and see how it works, and blow, it'd be super cool. We could decide whether we wanted to be a full service agency and then not be one. And then, you know, how do you unify that? You know, like if you talk about, like we've talked about before, about like Theseus's ship, right? Is like the ship where like you replace one part at a time until eventually like all the parts have been replaced. Is it the same ship, right? Like, right. How do you tie a company that's, like, changed business models and it's changed how it describes itself and, like, it's changed all of its employees? Like, what is the thing that, like, underlies all of that that, like, makes you feel like it's still your company? Or, like, at a certain point, do you just say, like, okay, like, maybe it doesn't need to be the same company. Maybe, like, I can just get someone else to run this and then start the next company. Like, how does, like, what's that feeling, you know?
Well, let me throw another ship metaphor at you.
Ooh, I love a good ship metaphor.
All the great ship metaphors.
I don't know who's... I haven't read The Odyssey. I think this is from The Odyssey. But the guy who has to be tied because of the sirens, who is that?
Strapped to the mast.
That's Odysseus.
Well, this is sort of a side point, but I would say to your point, like doing the shiny stuff, like being like, ooh, what's it like to be a full service agency? I don't recommend that because I think you probably knew what you wanted to do when you started the business in the first place. And again, I think if you ever think someone else's business looks easy, it's just because you don't understand it well enough. I learned the lesson the hard way. Like, now I won't make that mistake again. But I could have used someone tying me to the mast of my own ship and saying, no, we are not going to that island, period. Because
right.
It's really tempting, especially when you have money. And it is probably not going to work out. I think the only time that ever works out is when you find someone else who is your equivalent in that space and you decide to sort of go at it together. That is why, especially in creative fields, agencies rarely scale. They almost always acquihire and grow through acquisitions because, you know, you can't just scale a creative product. It's brand new every single time, no matter how hard you work to try to make it scalable. Creative talent is expired once it's used, you know, and you kind of can't use it again. And it's just hard to be really good at all of that stuff. And so I think that's where you end up in that kind of middle ground. But the ship, you know, Theseus's ship is a handful of employees who have become part of the DNA of the company. And I think it would not be the same company without those people. And I would say every single person on the team that's left is one of those people, thankfully. And I think that's a testament to sort of Drew's ability really to really boil everything down to its most essential elements and kill it.
One of the things I'm really curious about, because you've had to do a fair amount of, you know, hiring and firing and managing of creative people, which I think is really interesting and really challenging. We've talked on here before, again, about like the importance of creative people and content people who really understand what you're doing. And just because I know your business, I've seen, you know, a lot of people in there who are like very interesting, brilliant, creative minds. And I'm curious, like, what the process has been like for you know, hiring, for managing, for kind of keeping everyone in line, for lack of a better phrase. But just, I think that's interesting. I'm also curious about, like, you know, are the creative people who work well in the studio model the same people who work well as like freelancers, or is that kind of like a different skill set?
that's, I think, a highly underestimated aspect of building any business is the people who are often, I don't know, kind of the lifeblood of a company are not. And this is, I think this is true of almost anything. It's not just creative people. I mean, creative people have kind of a famous reputation for being difficult, but I think it's true of anything. I mean, they are not the ones who sell stuff. They're not the ones that often best interface with things. And I think, yeah, that was, we've done that a lot. You know, we've had a lot of people who are so good at jumping in as freelancers and solving a certain type of problem. And then we try to get them to be managers. We try to get them to interface with clients, or we try to get them, you know, to do, maybe they're good at 3 out of the 5 things we need. We try to get them to do the other 2 and it just doesn't work. It maybe they can do it, but the magic of the job very quickly wears off.
So what do you do there? Do you say like we have the wrong person or we have the wrong job description?
It's so often both. I mean,
it's like, if they're saying like, if you're saying they can do 3 out of the 5 things we need them to do, but not the other 2, like what if that's 2 jobs, or like what if those 2 things go to someone else's job? You know, like it's a hard thing to decide, you know?
It's really tough to scale a business because there are sort of the, I'll call them kind of owner operator types who can do everything. I kind of fall into that category where I can make a pretty good video and I can deal with clients and I can sell, but I'm not the best at any of those things. I'm a pretty general player, and there aren't a lot of roles for people like that. So you've either got people like that who, as the business grows and you cease sort of needing, you don't need general players anymore, you need experts. Well, those people kind of have to filter out. Or you, and again, we've experienced that. We've also experienced, you know, our company, you know, Fancy Rhino was 23 people for a while there. And that, so getting up to that point required a certain amount of slow and pretty painful at times sort of filtering out of people who were essential to the operations of the business when everyone did everything. And I think this is a classic startup problem across every industry. But scaling up to that point where we had 20 or so people, there was a very painful and often slower than it probably should have been if we were good business owners process of filtering out those people. And then there was also a slow process of beginning to realize we can't replace those people with other people who are just like that. We need experts, and that's a different type of job description. It's a different type of personality. It's, you know, it's overall, it, I mean, even being in a small market like Chattanooga, it's just a different challenge in terms of recruiting.
One of the things we've seen in our 30 companies is that just in investing, and then, you know, talking to a lot of other entrepreneurs and stuff, is just more than ever, I'm convinced that, you know, HR and hiring and firing are all like really learned skills that take a long time to develop, take a lot of thought and a lot of training. And the interesting thing to think about is that those skills are not frequently inherent in a founder, right? The kind of person who goes out and starts something and bootstraps it and builds it and goes out and gets money is typically not great at hiring. And
it's interesting
because I think that that if you kind of follow that thread, I think that's why a ton of companies fail. They can have a completely competent generalist who can build the thing up and, you know, understands every function of the business. But if you can't get the right people in and can't get them to buy into the vision that you're selling, is you're hopeless. You know, it's super interesting. But it sounds like you've learned a lot about that, you know, through the years, doing it well sometimes and tripping up other times.
Yeah, I would say I would maybe put a little bit of a spin on that in the sense that I think the founder types are very good generally at selling the vision. I think, not so good at understanding. Yeah, I mean, understanding the, to your point, the sort of nuanced skills required to, I mean, not even just, there's just so many things. I mean, even just the writing a job description. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do well. Understanding yeah. if yeah. someone fits that job description, very hard to do well. Because people want jobs, you know, and if you do a good job, I think one thing that we have run into is that if you do a good job of communicating who you are, people very quickly begin to understand who you are. And so then they can then regurgitate that back to you. And so they want a job. They have every right to want yep. that job and to represent themselves yep. in a certain way. And maybe it's subconscious, but they're going to tell you what you think, what you need to hear. And so a huge part of hiring is filtering through that and being like, I know you think you would be a good fit here, but you won't. And that is something that I think I've gotten a lot better at.
I feel like you guys sold the vision a little bit too hard that one time when you were hiring and a guy tattooed your logo on his arm and then you
oh
didn't
my gosh.
Hire him.
That was brutal.
Would you say it's an example of being maybe too good at selling the vision?
I think that's a very good example of that, actually. I don't know what she was thinking. What a dumpster fire.
This is going to be a good one, John. This is going to be a great one.
Yeah, it sounds like you're clipping a little bit. Are you getting a little excited over there?
I'm punchy, John. I am punchy.
Yeah. Orange, you glad I told you?
Mm-hmm. Orange, you glad I didn't say banana again? Please, my wife. She's very sick. My wife.
So, Zay, there should have been a little pop-up that came up.
Oh, no. No, he oh, departed. No. Is this what you're going to wear?
I love how you'll just wear anything.
Like an internet situation.
Might be an internet situation.
We might get some guy with some bumping speakers drive by, but I'll just...
Sure, well, that's good. That's good for you. Whatever's good for you, Zay.
Yeah, that folds some texture into the show anyway. Yeah, it's so weird because I'm sitting outdoors.
I always wondered about that, like when people win those sweepstakes to get like lifetime supply of Coke. What does that actually mean?
It's got to end.
There's a whole Ask Reddit thread about it.
Oh, really? Zay, you decided to get into the film industry in your 20s, and the first thing that I always do as a, you know, as a good student of economics is to, anytime we get approached by a company and our VC fund, is to go to the Michael Porter's Five Forces. Are you guys familiar with this?
No, you just outed me as a bad student of...
No, well, Michael Porter's is this the kind of like the dude of strategy, and he's at Harvard, and he basically coined a lot of really smart ideas about kind of applying like rigorous academic thought and modeling to business and strategy and how markets are organized. And a lot of it sounds like, I mean, a lot of it's just really straightforward, but one of his most famous like legacy things is the Five Forces, which is this really quick and dirty analysis you can do to like size up how competitive an industry is. And the Five Forces are the bargaining power of suppliers, the bargaining power of buyers, the threat of new entrants, the threat of substitutes, and the rivalry inside of the industry. And I was thinking about film because
we're in the wrong business.
You guys got it because you're passionate about it, and it's an amazing art form that I love very, very much. And we could talk about it endlessly. But I was just thinking about it here of like the threat of substitutes, that basically all entertainment is becoming free and it's like a race to the bottom on pricing, the threat of new entrants, the fact that there are millions of people who would love to be in this industry who are smart and hardworking and willing to work for low amounts of money, the threat of suppliers with unionized people who are unionized who are working for you in almost any segment of the industry, the bargaining power of buyers. Daniel and I have joked about, you know, the amount of control that studios and distributors have over different things and how everybody kind of takes their cut along the way. And then, of course, the rivalry within that unbelievably cutthroat, low margin industry where most of the time most people make no money. My question is for you, are you like a glutton for punishment? Is this something that you enjoy? Is just getting raked over the coals on this stuff something that you look forward to?
Yeah. Just give me a second while I pull the needles out from under my fingernails. Here's the thing. It's a really excellent question. I mean, part of the way our business model works is that we are attempting to sort of straddle both the sort of owner buyer side of things and the labor side. And I think I would feel very just utterly intimidated to try to enter exclusively on one side or the other.
Like just production.
I know a lot of people who are just trying, and by necessity, this even comes back to where we started, which is, should you take VC money? I know a lot of people that by necessity are just trying to make it as labor/talent. That is a incredibly just brutal slog to get through. If you get really lucky and you're really talented, you might get rocketed to the top and you can make a crap ton of money. Let's say you want to be a writer, right? Well, there are, I'm going to go ahead and say between film and TV, generously, there are probably 5,000 good jobs for writers in the entire industry.
Wow.
There are like 800,000 doctors in the United States. Let's be really generous. There are 10,000 writing jobs in Hollywood. And that's, A, that's way more than there really are, and B, that's when there are more TV shows being made than ever before, by a long shot. It's not quite as hard as getting into a professional sport, but it's pretty stinking close. So here's the thing. If you're just trying to get in, the other side of that is like, you're competing against people. Like, if I was just trying to come in as a writer, like a screenwriter in Hollywood, I'm not just competing against people my age who are going to age out in the next 3 years. I'm competing against Aaron Sorkin and, you know, other people like that who are never going to age out and have been doing it for a lot longer. And it's just brutally difficult to get in if you're just a talent. On the same sort of on the flip side of that, if you try to come in as just the money, or some version of that, you've got to have just buckets of money to just throw around because film's expensive. If you want to get in just on the money side, it's kind of like VC. Like, you're not going to get access to good deals and get and be able to be around long enough if you don't have a significant amount of money. And so the reason I'm doing it and the reason I'm not like scared is because we're kind of trying to do both. And it's sort of like, okay, yeah, to your point, John, if we were just an investment fund, we would take our little management fee and that would be barely enough to sustain a very, very, very small staff. And we would spend all of our time just managing a giant portfolio of companies, praying that some of them work out in a big way. If we were just talent, we would all be living on nothing and praying that one of us gets a job as soon as we possibly can. What I think is interesting about the model that we're doing, and it's kind of a micro version of what larger companies like Netflix are doing in their own way. They're sort of targeting different aspects of the business, but like we're basically
But they're doing like production and distribution.
Exactly. And so for us, rather than doing production and distribution, what we're saying is we're doing production and we're being the talent.
It feels like at every level someone takes a cut, right? So like the more of those levels that you can merge together, the bigger your cut is, right?
That's exactly
right. So it's like if you have like the talent gets their money, the production gets their money, the distribution gets their money, everyone's got agents and all these people who are taking cuts of their cuts, And so like it's like how many of these cuts can we like merge into one?
Well, it's interesting. It's a hard balance to do because then you have to be good at all those things, right? So that's the really, really hard thing to do. The company that's like analogous would be Hobby Lobby, which is really interesting because they started out as like a distributor, basically, just a retail distributor. And they slowly realize that, like, oh yeah, everyone's taking their 5%. And so now they slowly vertically integrated to the point where now they actually own their factories in China. And I think they do their own logistics, you know? Right. So it's like they're getting the manufacturer's margin, they're getting the logistics margin, they're getting the retail margin, they're getting, and that's how they've like turned their company into this like massive empire, which is very confusing to people because they're just selling like yarn and craft supplies. But it's really interesting because if you can figure out how to be good.
And they're saving some money on taking an ethical stance on health insurance.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I've learned that, again, I've learned that lesson the hard way of, like, I don't want to vertically integrate indefinitely. You know, like, to me, there's a immediate and very attractive benefit to being both a producer, a financier, not both, to being a producer, a financier, and a writer, and theoretically a director too. But those are all relatively closely related. I don't want to get into distribution right now. You know, like, if I ever get into distribution, it's going to be because we partner with somebody who does it, and that's that. But yeah, it's always a balance. Because again, I'm like, there's somebody who likes distribution more, they're better at it, and therefore they're going to beat me. You know, that's kind of how that works. But as long as, yeah, those things kind of work together, and I think you can begin to thread that needle a little bit.
I think it's really interesting with like all of the content industries right now. Like, it's like the bottom of the stack is starting to collapse in all of those industries, you know, where like what you're talking about now, it's like your talent and production and like some money, you know. It's like I think it's interesting. So like, we have this buddy Eric who I guess manages a bunch of musicians and like has a bunch of people who he like connects to each other, and everyone ends up making some music, right? And he's been trying for a very long time to like be successful at this, and like he's finally getting to the place where like, you know, he gets to have conversations with Apple and Spotify and all those people, like, where he has something to offer them, you know. It's not just like everyone gets their album on iTunes, you know, type of thing. But it's like, hey, we have this artist, we did all of his branding, we did all of his production, we have the talent, we have the producers, we have all the instrumentation, you know, we have like all of this, you know, social media talent in our corner that's pushing stuff, right? And so it's like all of a sudden we've like collapsed a lot of the things that like a label offers into like an in-house thing, and we're still like a super agile team of like a couple of people. Totally. And then we're able to like take this finished product of like a pop star or whatever to Apple and say, would you put this on the front page of your thing? It will give you like the exclusive launch, and it does really well for them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's an interesting thing. It's like a lot of these industries, I think, where like there's been traditionally like a really hierarchical distribution system that involves like 12 different levels of everyone taking 10%, which is impossible. I know, numbers. but you know, like a lot of levels of people taking 10%. It's like, I think a lot of like young, hungry people are starting to like collapse the lower half of that and are happy to take 30, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want to do this whole, like, look, trust me, it's hard enough to make money when you get into one of the top three festivals in the country and try to sell your movie there. Like, it's still really hard. There's a lot of people. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. Like, you know, like 4,000 movies got submitted to Sundance, probably. These are feature films. I mean, the barrier to entry is making an entire movie. That's not even easy. If it sucks, it's still a pain, you know? And like 4,000, and they probably accepted 100, and probably 60 of those have movie stars in them. And so then you're part of this tiny little subset of movies that get in, and not even all of those sold to distributors. You know, I mean, it's, And of the ones that sold to distributors, an even smaller percentage of them will ever actually even make their budgets back. And so there's this growing sort of groundswell of like independent filmmaking that I think is wonderful. But I'm also kind of like, 99% of those people will be making their making money and making a living doing something else. I want to figure out how to make money doing it. Not just because I want to make more money, but because I don't want to do other things. I get a lot of like college students who sort of ask for advice, and I think I used to soft pedal it a lot and just be like, yeah, you can kind of do whatever you want. You just got to put your mind to it. You know, that kind of spiel.
Yeah.
And lately I've just kind of been like, pretty brutal about, like, what are you prepared to give up? Because I had a very, and I can, I'm not even bragging about it. It's just it, because it wasn't even in my control. Like, a lot of things, you know, fancy and the investors that we met and the timing of it all, a lot of things that were completely out of my control that amplified the incredibly hard work that I did, you know, all of those things happened. And I'm still like in the, I'm still in the like struggling to figure out if I'm going to make it work category in the film industry. And I started with a lot of like things in my favor. And so, yeah, I've started just being real with people, like, look, I think it's cool you want to make movies, but it's going to be really, really, really hard. And what I've realized is if they really want it bad enough, then me saying that is not going to do anything to deter them at all. Mm-hmm. Similar, John, to like what you're saying, like, yeah, you know what? Like, I know exactly how hard it is to make it, but I don't care. I'm going to make it work, you know, because I'm stupid and I'm an entrepreneur and that's how it goes, you know, like, but, you know, if I can deter you by telling you how hard it is, that's a really good sign that you should probably go find another line of work.
Yeah. Or like, you know, if you're thinking of opening a movie theater and someone tells you that it's a restaurant managing job and that throws you off the scent, turns out you weren't designed to be a cinemateur.
Yes, exactly.
I quote Merlin Mann way too much on this, but he said a lot of interesting things about this as well, about like if you're saying to yourself, I want to go be a screenwriter, and you have to schedule out time to go, you know, be a screenwriter, and you are deterred by how miserable that life could be, and you're not just obsessed with it, and you don't just have some sort of, you know, twisted obsession with doing it and doing it well, you probably shouldn't be writing screenplays. And I think that really does apply to a lot of different things. And it gets back to that idea of the difference between, you know, this romanticized version of something in your head and actually doing the hard work of doing it when you're not up for it.
Totally. I mean, I think people should be more honest about that stuff, you know, for that reason. I mean, some of it you have to learn on your own, but I think I guarantee that you had conversations with people that could have probably been a little bit more brutally honest about that reality and might have introduced you to that concept earlier, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, not being totally honest about that is actually doing a disservice to the people you're talking to, right?
Yeah, you might waste 5 years of their life.
Because then they're just going to waste time. Yeah. Back to kind of like, what are you willing to sacrifice? I mean, I know people per sort of the film industry, like they want to be writers. Well, the best way to do that is A, to write constantly. And then, you know, the ones that I know that are really making a go at it have basically, you know, worked really, really, really hard and spent no money so that they can take off like 6 months and just finish a bunch of stuff and like write, put themselves out there and do all that kind of stuff. Because, but again, that's a certain type of sort of entrepreneurship. It's like, there are a lot of people who would rather just kind of slowly climb the ladder, make a little more money each year, have a certain degree of job security, and I completely respect that. But there are certain things that just require a little more than that. You know, it requires being like, I'm not going to have health insurance, I'm going to have to share a house with four other people, and I'm going to have to sell my car, you know. And it may not work out, and then I may be back to square one. But if you really want to do it, you're probably not going to not do it because of that.
Someone won like a lifetime supply of like Pepsi or something, and they're like, we got 12 cases of Pepsi.
Oh, I thought you said a lifetime supply of Hep C. I was like, I think that's the only quantity it comes in. That's good.
So cool.
Everybody needs a hobby.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me more about that some other time, John.
I'm drinking evening coffee right now, which is kind of a mix them up for me. But you know, I gotta be revved up for these things.
Is this the show?
I think it's done. Sorry. Humble brag. Not even a humble brag. I'm just gonna brag.
Yeah.
And that's its own crazy
ball of wax.
Curve and yeah, ball of wax. A big hot melting ball of wax. I have an idea for a podcast that I'll probably never do because the delayed gratification will prevent me from doing it, but it's the basically like my business diary where I talk about everything that's going on like unfiltered, and then I release it like 10 years later when it's not sensitive.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You should totally do that.
There's that's... so many interesting things where I'm like, this weird employee situation or this weird thing with a investor or whatever, and I'm like, I can't talk about it right now, no, but like, Zay, God, it would be so interesting
this.
One day.
You don't even have to do any of the hard work. Like, your job would be like my job, where like you don't have to do anything. You just show up and right. say things. And then later, down the road, you can hire someone, or you'll already have someone working at one of your companies, and just be like, hey, will you be my John Drexler and edit these like 400 hours of audio I've created?
No, totally.
No,
John, you're
John,
a hero.
Talk about one day we'll get sponsors and we'll replace you.
You want to talk about a labor of love. Oh, boy. Oh, Jiminy Crickets.
Oh, boy. The edits.
John, I know how that goes. Because you know what? I can promise you, everybody's like, God, John and Daniel, this podcast is so great. And you're just sitting there quietly like...
No,
it's terrible. It's terrible. I'm the worst.
That's why every time Daniel and I are presented with podcast awards, and every time I get, you know, we get interviewed by some of the big podcast publications, I'm always kind of looking down my nose at him, like, you know, I put more hours in, dog.
Yeah.
But I always give the award speech, and I thank my parents before I thank you. I just want to thank God and my parents and the entire staff that supported me, and also John, my co-host.
Right, right.
I'd like to thank our production staff.
John's last.
Yeah.
I was just watching the Chance the Rapper.
Oh, giving away the money?
Well, I love giving away the money, and I watched his Grammy acceptance speech. And the first like four people he thanks are all God. This is so good. He's like, I'd like to thank God.
That's awesome.
I'd also like to, you know what? I got this victory, but the glory goes to God. I'd also like to thank God for giving me my parents. I was like,
so awesome.
I love the Father, it. Son, Holy Spirit, and the Trinity as a whole.